Whereas in June of 1970, the largest bankruptcy in American history shocked Wall Street, the White House, and millions of ordinary citizens who thought their investments were safer than government bonds. Penn Central Railroad, formed just 2 years earlier from the merger of two legendary rail lines, owed $3.2 billion when it collapsed. Adjusted for inflation, that's over $24 billion today, dwarfing even Lehman Brothers when measured against the economy of its time. But here's what made this bankruptcy different from every corporate failure before or since. Penn Central wasn't a speculative startup or a struggling industrial dinosaur. It was considered one of the safest investments in America. Pension funds, insurance companies, and widows' trusts all held Penn Central bonds because they were supposed to be as secure as the steel rails themselves. The real mystery isn't that Penn Central went bankrupt. It's that nobody, not the board, not Wall Street analysts, not even the federal regulators who watched the company daily, saw it coming until 72 hours before the end. This is the story of how America's largest railroad became America's largest fraud, hidden in plain sight. On February 1st, 1968, two giants of American industry joined together in what the press called the merger of the century. The Pennsylvania Railroad and the New York Central Railroad had competed for over a century, laying parallel tracks across the same routes, building duplicate terminals, and bleeding cash in a rivalry that dated back to the Civil War. For decades, industry experts argued that combining these two would create efficiencies that could save both companies. Stuart Saunders, the chairman who orchestrated the deal, promised shareholders that the merger would save $80 million annually through eliminated redundancies. Wall Street believed him. The stock traded at healthy levels. Bond ratings remained investment grade. But inside the newly formed Penn Central Transportation Company, something else was happening entirely. The two railroads had different operating systems, incompatible computer networks, and management teams that despised each other. Pennsylvania Railroad executives refused to take orders from New York Central managers, and vice versa. Freight cars from one system would arrive at switching yards controlled by the other and simply sit there, sometimes for weeks, because no one wanted to process the paperwork. Alfred Perlman, who had run New York Central before the merger, fought constantly with David Bevin, the chief financial officer inherited from Pennsylvania Railroad. Perlman wanted to invest in new equipment and cut unprofitable passenger routes. Bevin wanted to diversify into real estate and other businesses to offset railroad losses. Saunders sided with Bevin, not because the strategy was sound, but because Bevin controlled the financial reporting. And Bevin had discovered something remarkable. He could make the railroad look profitable on paper even as it hemorrhaged cash in reality. David Bevin was not a railroad man. He was a financier, trained at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, and he understood something that the old line railroad executives did not. Accounting could be far more flexible than steel rails. Penn Central owned enormous amounts of real estate, station properties in city centers, rail yards that had appreciated dramatically in value, mineral rights, and development land. Bevin created a complex web of subsidiaries and partnerships to manage these assets, keeping them technically separate from the railroad's operations. When the railroad lost money, Bevin would sell a piece of real estate from one subsidiary to another at an inflated price, booking the gain as operating income. On paper, Penn Central reported profits. In cash flow reality, the railroad was burning through reserves. In 1968, Penn Central reported a profit of $87 million. The railroad's actual operating loss that year was $183 million. The difference was accounting fiction. Paper transactions between subsidiaries that generated no actual cash. Bevin doubled down on diversification, acquiring stakes in an airline, an oil company, a hotel chain, and even an amusement park. Penn Central bought Executive Jet Aviation, a private aircraft company, for $21 million in cash at the exact moment the railroad couldn't afford to repair its own locomotives. the investments were disasters. The amusement park, Buckeye Pipeline, lost money immediately. The airline investments collapsed. But Bevin kept acquiring, kept reporting profits, and kept reassuring Wall Street that diversification would save the railroad. Meanwhile, the actual trains were falling apart. By 1969, Penn Central's locomotives were so unreliable that the company had to rent engines from competitors just to move freight. Derailments became routine. Customers fled to trucking companies that could promise delivery schedules Penn Central could no longer meet. Saunders and Bevin told the board this was temporary. They told Wall Street the railroad was modernizing. They told regulators that profitability was just around the corner. None of it was true. The deception worked for exactly 28 months. In early 1970, Penn Central's cash position became critical. The railroad needed $100 million immediately just to make payroll and cover operating expenses. Bevin had been using short-term commercial paper, essentially corporate IOUs, to cover cash shortfalls, constantly rolling over debt to keep cash flowing. In May 1970, the commercial paper market froze. Investors who had been lending to Penn Central for decades suddenly refused to renew loans. Word was spreading that something was wrong. Bevin went to the banks. Penn Central needed an emergency loan of $200 million to avoid defaulting on its obligations. The banks demanded to see the company's real financial position, not the rosy reports given to shareholders, but the actual cash flow statements. What they saw shocked them. Penn Central was losing $1 million per day in actual cash. The railroad had obligations exceeding $300 million due within 90 days and almost no liquid assets. The real estate empire that Bevin had built was illiquid, worth billions on paper, but impossible to sell quickly enough to matter. The banks refused the loan. On June 8, 1970, Saunders finally told the board of directors the truth. Penn Central was insolvent. The company couldn't pay its bills. Bankruptcy was inevitable. Board members were stunned. Several had invested their personal fortunes in Penn Central stock, believing the company's own financial reports. One board member, a retired banker, asked Saunders directly, "How did this happen without anyone knowing?" Saunders had no answer. The truth was that people did know, Saunders, Bevin, and a handful of top executives, but they had hidden the reality behind accounting manipulations and outright lies for more than 2 years. The Nixon administration learned that Penn Central was collapsing on June 19, 1970. The timing couldn't have been worse. Penn Central employed 96,000 people directly, and hundreds of thousands more worked for suppliers and customers dependent on the railroad. The company's bankruptcy would be the largest in American history, and it threatened to trigger a cascade of failures across the financial system. Insurance companies held Penn Central bonds as reserves to back policies. Banks had lent hundreds of millions against Penn Central assets. Pension funds owned massive positions in Penn Central stock and bonds. If the railroad went down, it would take chunks of the financial system with it. Federal Reserve Chairman Arthur Burns personally called the White House to warn that Penn Central's failure could trigger a liquidity crisis similar to the bank runs of the 1930s. The administration attempted a bailout. Secretary of Defense David Packard was asked to guarantee $200 million in loans to Penn Central on national security grounds. The railroad transported military equipment and was supposedly essential to defense operations. But the numbers didn't work. Even $200 million wouldn't save Penn Central. The railroad needed at least $500 million and possibly a billion, and there was no guarantee that any amount of money could fix the operational chaos or the management disaster. On June 21, 1970, 72 hours after the administration learned of the crisis, the bailout was rejected. Penn Central would be allowed to fail. On June 21, 1970, Penn Central filed for bankruptcy protection in federal court in Philadelphia. The stock, which had traded above $80 per share 2 years earlier, closed at $5.50. By the end of the week, it was worth less than $1. Here's what makes the Penn Central collapse genuinely mysterious. There were dozens of people whose job was specifically to prevent this exact scenario. Penn Central was regulated by the Interstate Commerce Commission, which reviewed its financial reports quarterly. The ICC had the authority to investigate suspicious accounting and demand corrective action. They did nothing. Wall Street analysts covered Penn Central extensively. Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, and other major firms published regular research reports recommending Penn Central bonds as safe, high-quality investments. Not one analyst predicted bankruptcy until the week it happened. Penn Central's board of directors included experienced executives from major banks and corporations. They attended quarterly meetings, reviewed financial statements, and approved major decisions. None raised alarm bells. How did everyone miss it? The answer lies in a combination of deliberate deception and systemic incentives to look the other way. Bevin's accounting manipulations were sophisticated enough to pass routine audits. He used real estate transactions between subsidiaries to create paper profits, but the transactions technically followed accounting rules of the time. Auditors could verify that the real estate existed and that the sales had occurred. What they couldn't easily detect was that the entire structure was designed to hide operating losses. The ICC relied on reports submitted by the railroads themselves. The commission had fewer than a dozen staff members monitoring the entire railroad industry nationwide. They physically could not conduct detailed investigations of every major railroad annually. Wall Street analysts had a different problem: access. They relied on information provided by management, and management lied. When analysts asked difficult questions, Saunders and Bevin provided plausible explanations backed by cherry-picked data. Analysts who pushed harder found themselves cut off from management access, making it impossible to cover the company effectively. And the board of directors? They trusted management just as they were supposed to. Board members had neither the time nor the resources to independently verify financial reports. When Saunders told them diversification was working, they believed him because he was the chairman, and that's what chairmen do. They tell the board how the company is performing. But there's a darker explanation, too. Several board members and executives sold Penn Central stock in the months before the bankruptcy, while simultaneously reassuring public investors that the company was healthy. David Bevin himself sold 15,000 shares in early 1970, netting $250,000, while publicly stating that Penn Central's finances were sound. This wasn't incompetence, it was fraud. The Penn Central bankruptcy reorganization took 6 years and became a landmark case in corporate law. Investigators from the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Department of Justice, and congressional committees spent years untangling Penn Central's finances. What they discovered was systematic misrepresentation of financial condition, insider trading, and potentially criminal fraud. Stuart Saunders resigned in disgrace the day after bankruptcy. David Bevin was fired. Alfred Perlman, who had opposed many of Bevin's strategies, left the company and cooperated with investigators. Bevin and several other executives were charged with fraud. The key charge: they had knowingly misrepresented Penn Central's financial condition to investors while personally profiting from stock sales. Bevin's trial ended in a mistrial in 1974, and federal prosecutors chose not to retry the case, citing the difficulty of proving criminal intent in complex accounting fraud. Saunders was never criminally charged, though he faced civil lawsuits from shareholders for years afterward. The railroad itself was carved up. The federal government eventually nationalized Penn Central's passenger operations, folding them into the newly created Amtrak. The freight operations were merged with several other bankrupt Northeastern railroads to form Conrail, which operated under government ownership until it was privatized in 1987. The Penn Central collapse directly led to major reforms in bankruptcy law, securities regulation, and corporate governance. Congress passed new disclosure requirements for publicly traded companies. The SEC gained new authority to investigate suspicious accounting practices. and boards of directors faced new legal obligations to actively oversee management rather than passively trust executives. The financial damage from Penn Central's collapse rippled through the economy for years. Shareholders lost approximately $1.8 billion in equity value. Bondholders eventually recovered about 40 cents on the dollar after years of bankruptcy proceedings. Pension funds that had held Penn Central securities as safe. Conservative investments faced shortfalls that affected retirees for decades. But the broader economic impact was even larger. The commercial paper market, the short-term lending market that companies used to cover daily operating expenses, froze completely after Penn Central's failure. Investors realized that even companies with investment-grade ratings could collapse without warning. Access to short-term credit dried up across the economy. The Federal Reserve was forced to intervene, creating emergency lending facilities to keep credit flowing. Economists later estimated that Penn Central's failure contributed to the 1970 recession, which saw unemployment rise from 3.5% to 6% within 12 months. The railroad industry itself was fundamentally reshaped. Penn Central's collapse convinced policymakers that the era of private passenger rail service was over in America. Federal takeover of passenger operations became inevitable, creating the structure that still exists today: private freight, public passenger service. Perhaps most significantly, Penn Central destroyed the assumption that blue-chip corporate bonds were essentially risk-free. Before 1970, pension funds and insurance companies treated bonds from major corporations as nearly equivalent to government securities. After Penn Central, that assumption was gone. Risk management became a central concern for institutional investors in a way it hadn't been before. So why didn't anyone see Penn Central's collapse coming? The answer is that many people did see warning signs, but the incentive structure rewarded looking away. Executives saw problems but believed they could trade their way out through accounting manipulation and diversification. They had personal fortunes tied to Penn Central stock and faced catastrophic losses if they admitted the truth. Board members saw inconsistencies but trusted management because that's what boards did in 1970. Corporate governance, as we understand it today, with independent directors, audit committees, and active oversight, largely didn't exist. Regulators saw red flags but lacked resources and authority to investigate fully. The Interstate Commerce Commission was designed to regulate monopolies, not to catch fraud. Wall Street analysts saw troubling signs but relied on management access for information. Analysts who challenged management too aggressively found themselves frozen out. And investors saw what they wanted to see: a safe, stable railroad company with a century of history and a government-backed quasi-monopoly on transportation. The real mystery isn't why nobody saw it coming. It's why so many people who had pieces of the puzzle chose not to put them together until it was too late. Penn Central collapsed because everyone involved, executives, directors, regulators, analysts, and investors, had reasons to believe everything was fine, right up until the moment it wasn't. And that's the lesson that makes Penn Central's failure relevant more than 50 years later. The same incentive structure that allowed a $3.2 billion fraud to hide in plain sight in 1970 still exists today. The names change, the accounting techniques evolve, the industries shift, but the fundamental dynamic, where everyone involved has a reason not to ask the hard questions until it's too late, remains. Penn Central didn't fail because of one corrupt executive or one accounting trick or one bad merger. It failed because an entire system of checks and balances looked the other way until failure became inevitable. And when the largest bankruptcy in American history finally happened, the only real surprise was that anyone was surprised at all.